Hello, welcome to Outdoors in Scotland. My name is John Burns, and this is my podcast for people who like to be outdoors. Autumn is well and truly here in the Highlands. I was camping in Glenafric only last night, and the temperature is coming down. It was a wonderful, mystical place to camp. Yeah, my guest today is a man, I have to say, of many parts. You know, it's in my little show, sometimes it's difficult to get everything in. He's a writer, a surfer, a camper van owner, and a green activist, someone who campaigns for the environment. I'd really like to ask him about that. My guest is the camper van man himself, I think you'd have to call him, Martin Dory. How are you, Martin?
I'm really well, thank you. Yeah, not bad at all. I didn't camp last night. I'm in a hotel room, unfortunately.
There's a role for those as well, you know?
Yeah, I suppose so.
I wanted to ask you, you've written Take the Slow Road and a lot of books about a different philosophy in travelling, I think. But I wanted to ask you, first of all, you've got this iconic image of the Volkswagen camper van, which is on the covers of your books. And there's something really special about those little camper vans, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, they're sort of as much symbolic these days as they are practical, because they're not really that practical. It's an easy symbol, isn't it, for kind of, you know, groovy good times on the road. It's such a cliche, but it does work and people respond to it. Although actually in my later books, I've actually not put a VW on the cover as a matter of principle, because I think a lot of us have moved on from the kind of old fashioned 1960s cutesy vans that, you know, that are tiny. You look at the size of them, they're smaller than an average Range Rover these days. but there's something really special about them. I've had quite a few and loved every single one of them. But when it came down to it, if I want to go camping for long periods of time in the winter or long periods of time over the summer, you know, I need something different and something that's a bit more reliable, something a bit bigger. So it's kind of, you know, the whole principle is kind of encapsulated by those vans, but not necessarily truthful, if you like, because they are quite impractical.
Well, I think you're right about them being a symbol, because, you know, I think all of us, if you go to the outdoors, I've got memories of those little vans. I can remember when I must have been about 8, and it was pouring with rain, and I was in a very with my dad and a little tent that was basically blown away, and some friends turned up in one of those VW vans. And I can remember sitting in there drinking hot chocolate, watching the condensation run down the windows, you know.
Yeah, well, I think the fact that our generation, if you like, the sort of like late young people and lots of my friends and lots of my contemporaries have got memories of when their parents had them, because they were literally ubiquitous, you know, they were everywhere. Yeah. In the 70s and even in the 80s, and we remember them, and we remember them really fondly, you know, and so we hanker after the sort of imagined kind of perfection of that sort of lifestyle. I remember, you know, I've sat in my van plenty of times with a hot cup of tea looking at the condensation on the window, so I get it totally.
Yeah, it's a sort of pastime, really, isn't it? That we all get up to, you know.
It happens. Or sheltering from the midges.
Oh, God, yes. That's a fact. Anything that's midge-proof is a great boon, you know. So what's the kind of philosophy behind your books? Take the Slow Road sort of says a little bit about it, but is it about taking your time, or what inspired you with the books?
The reason the idea came about was because I did an article years ago for Coast magazine about a really slow journey up the west coast of Wales with my kids, and we basically sort of walked, and we went crabbing, and we went swimming, and we went fishing, and we, you know, went and had fish and chips, and we didn't travel very far, but we just took this really lovely journey along great roads and just took our time. And that's the sort of philosophy, really. It's slow down, you know, it's not top gear, you can't go fast anyway, there's no point. And try and immerse yourself, you know, be a bit more present in the journeys you take.
Yeah, that's an important thing. It's the sort of thing that I've been doing recently, because I'm now a devotee to the hot tent, you see, which is a kind of canvas Volkswagen camper, you know, that allows me to camp in the winter.
A hot tent?
Yeah, have you not come across a hot tent? Hot tent is it's a Norwegian style tent, really, Scandinavian in origin, and it's a big canvas bell tent, and it's heated by a wood burning stove.
Oh right, okay, yeah, got you.
Yeah, so that's what I've been into recently. But you're also very committed to fighting for the environment. And tell us about your new charity, the 2 Minute Foundation. What's that about?
So I've actually stepped aside from that now, but I still support them.
Right.
The 2 Minute Foundation came about. About 13 or 14 years ago, I was taking a walk along my local beach and it's covered in plastic.
Yeah.
And I thought I would see if I could use social media to make a difference, basically.
Right.
And so I started using this hashtag 2 Minute Beach Clean, and sort of just went back to the beach and did 2 minutes and kind of was just trying to inspire other people to do 2 minutes. And it sort of went a bit crazy, got a bit out of control, and has became a charity in 2019. Right. And I was the CEO for a couple of years. And now, because it's become a bigger thing than I am, if you like. And so there are other people running it and doing great things with it. There's a beach school that they run teaching kids how to take care of the environment. They look after about 1,000 beach clean stations around the UK, Ireland, or sort of administrate them, if you like. And just sort of try and encourage people to be a bit more kind of careful where they go. So pick up litter, basically. And when that comes down to camping, it's kind of like, you know, if you turn up somewhere and there's mess, you clear it up before you pitch. Then you pitch and then you clear up before you go. So actually that, you know, we as campers don't get held responsible for mess. And you know, you'll know all about this. And I've been up to I last went up to Loch Lomond, and, you know, crikey, the mess up there that people are leaving. We need to work really hard to make sure that we don't lose those rights.
Absolutely, that's a whole different argument, really, if we get into that. Well, I mean, I walk along beaches sometimes, obviously, myself, and I wonder about picking up plastic and that sort of thing. But I sort of think, well, you know, I pick it up. Do you think that one person or we as individuals can actually make a difference?
Yes, I really do. I think the difference comes when you consider simple things. So one plastic bottle will break down into 1,000 or more pieces of microplastic in time in the sea. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be eaten by fish, and that's going to go into the fish's stomach and then eventually leach chemicals and toxins. It's going to bioaccumulate up the food chain. We're going to eat something bigger and we're going to take that toxin on ourselves. We know that they've found microplastics in blood now. We know that they find microplastics in lungs. So every little bit matters. The other thing is that if you find a piece of rope, you know, on the beach and you remove it from the beach, it's not going to end up strangling a seal or a bird or something like that.
Right.
So it makes an active difference. But the other thing about it is, if you imagine everybody did it, like everybody who goes camping, if everybody tied it up, you know, we wouldn't have a problem. So the idea is that 2 minutes is enough time for you to feel like you've done your bit, but it's also enough time. Sort of, it tells you when you can stop. It sort of gives you an excuse because it's so overwhelming. So when you look at beach, like you go walking on a beach and you think, I'll do 2 minutes, and you look at the rest of the beach and you think, Christ, what difference has that made? Actually, it will make a difference, but you need to think that actually you shouldn't get overwhelmed by it, and you just need to keep going, and other people can pick up the other 2 minutes, you know. So it's a sort of safety in numbers game, but as I said, each 2 minutes does make a difference, because every bit of plastic that's not on the beach or in the environment is a piece of plastic that's not going to damage us in some way.
Yeah, that's an important message, really. And also, the marine environment is as challenged as the land, really, isn't it? It's under threat from all kinds of things. But I mean, I'm hearing that you know, we all live in these cheap, you know, the fleeces that have been recycled. But is it right that every time you wash one of those fleeces, you're actually flushing little particles of plastic into the environment? Is that right?
Yeah. In short, there are some staggering figures. I think it's about 17,000 tiny fibres per wash.
Really?
Yeah, so which is why I would always choose like merino base layers over plastic base layers. I don't think I own any plastic clothes other than my outer shells, because I can't afford Ventile. But because yes. When every time you wash a fleece, even a recycled fleece, it's shedding microplastics, and that is going straight into the ocean. There's no doubt about it. We know the connection, because they're too small to get through. You know, if cotton bud sticks can get through sewage treatment plants, tiny little microfibers off your fleeces can get there as well. And also you're breathing those in too. So it's pretty frightening. I mean, it's hard to kind of be so militant about plastics because it's impossible to avoid it. But, you know, I do try and avoid it as much as I possibly can in my own personal life, because I just don't want to have that stuff near me.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's only really recently become sort of evident to me that, you know, the clothes we wear do have an impact on the environment. I mean, I'm very guilty that sort of in the 70s and 80s, I ran about all over the hills in newly acquired nylon Gore-Tex jackets, dripping chemicals wherever I went, you know, occurred to me at the time.
Well, I know, I don't think it occurred to anybody. And I think, you know, we're also, I mean, the outdoor industry is so kind of, as much as any other industry, is really kind of enamored and kind of bows at the feet of technology and innovation. And actually, until recently, you know, with people like Patagonia and Outkit and Howie's starting to take a more responsible approach to Finisterre as well, and I'm sure there are others, that actually we didn't really realise what was going on. You know, I wore fleeces. I had a Birkhaus fleece. I loved it, you know. And that was made from plastic bottles even back in the 80s. But I didn't know that every time I washed it, it was flushing plastic down the drain. And it's really frightening. And I think that, you know, the more people realise, the more, you know, hopefully people will switch. Or they'll wash their clothes in. There's a thing called a guppy bag, which you can wash in your man-made fibres in. It's like a really fine mesh bag. You wash all your stuff in it and it collects all the fibres, and it's great. And there's also a product coming out soon from friends of mine at the Cleaner Seas Group, who are creating a filter for washing machines, which is a filter that basically filters out all the particles that come through your washing.
Right. I mean, the manufacturer should have done it years ago. What's the bag called again? Sorry?
The bag called is a guppy bag.
Guppy?
Yeah, Guppy. They're made in Holland, I think, and they're great. They're only about 20 quid, and you can use them time and time and time again. It's like a kind of zip bag. You basically wash all your fleeces and all your nylon and all your spandex and all that kind of stuff. In a bag, and it collects all the microfibers, stops it going down the drain.
That's a great idea. I've never heard of that at all.
It's a really simple solution, you know, and that's the other point about the 2 Minute Foundation is about. You can solve problems in a short period of time. Like it's no hassle to go online and order one of those and just remember to keep using it. And actually you're preventing a greater problem, which is great. So.
Oh, I've never heard of that. Well, you are, of course, you were in 2020 named by the Wombles as one of their litter heroes, which I think you're the first person who's been decorated by the Wombles I've ever had on.
Oh yeah. I know. Do you know what? I got a few years ago I got an award from Theresa May. Which I almost sent back. But but actually I have to say, being named as a Wombles hero is like the pinnacle of anything I could ever done. Nothing I will do. apart from having a letter from David Attenborough or something.
it's the sort of eco equivalent of a knighthood, really, isn't it?
Oh, the Wombles, come on, the original litter pickers.
It's certainly where I can remember them now, Uncle Bulgaria and all that sort of stuff, you know.
Yeah, love it.
So you've written quite a number of books, and obviously, you know, which is very close to my heart. Obviously, you've been you travel to Scotland quite a bit. What's your favorite? Well, you live in Cornwall, don't you? But what's your favorite area of the country, do you think?
I mean, I've always loved Scotland. I used to go up there to surf on the north coast a bit, and I've been to the Outer Hebrides a few times.
Oh right.
And I've been all over Scotland actually. And I'm coming up. I'm starting next year. I'm starting another book about Scotland. I'm really looking forward to that. I don't know really. I love Harris and Lewis. Really like it. But at the same time, I love the fact that in Scotland you can kind of point your vehicle or your van or your feet or your front wheel of your bike in any direction, and generally it's going to be pretty great. I like the borders actually. The borders.
Yes.
People from England just drive straight through, and it's like, you know, it's like 75 miles of amazing nothingness. It's wonderful. So, you know, and that whole area, I cycled a lot of the Seven Stains cycle routes when I was up. Mm-hmm. Which are all down there, and they're amazing. I can't wait to get back. Actually, I've been in France, I've been in Spain this year, England and Wales last year, and France the year before. So I've not been up to Scotland in a long time. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh right, yeah. Well, obviously I live here, but the Western Isles are particularly, if you like beaches. Beaches in the Western Isles are awesome, really, aren't they?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, what's the one that everybody goes on about? Luskentire, if I'm pronouncing it right. Is one of those, and the Harris beaches are just beautiful. You know, hopefully not too ravaged by camper vans going up there. You know, you hear stories. The last time I was in the Outer Hebrides, it was 25 degrees and I skinnied it on Harris.
Wow, I have to say that's fairly rare. Yeah,
no, I've got amazing memories of it, so maybe I'm being skewed.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult thing, as you know, up sort of in the north of Scotland. There's a lot of controversy about things like the North Coast 500, about how we're really having to look now at how we're using our wild places, our countryside, and it's trying to find a way, I think, of sharing it without destroying it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the dilemma that I face regularly, you know, in myself. You know, I write guidebooks about people going and taking amazing journeys.
Sure.
And actually, I need to make sure that they take them responsibly, and I'm helping them do that. And I feel a great weight of responsibility. I sometimes feel like, well, I need to get out of my van because it's you know, an internal combustion engine burning fossil fuels. If I was finding an electric camper van, of which there are very few available, it would still be a similar problem. So I'm coming to the sort of the conclusion that what we need to do, we can go there, but then we maybe need to park, and then we go off on foot or on our bikes, and we go, or kayaks or SUPs or however you make your journeys, and just do them in a different way. That's where I'm coming to. And I, you know, because I've just read so much about it. I've got a friend who lives on Lewis, and he's sort of quite up with what's happening in Scotland. Particularly the Outer Hebrides, a guy called Andrew Ditton, who you should definitely speak to at some point. He's amazing. And he keeps me up to date and kind of how people are feeling. Sometimes it's not great. I don't like the idea that that what we do is being unpopular. Because it's damaging, it shouldn't be. We should be.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very difficult dilemma, I think. I mean, you know, this is a, as you say, it's a wonderful place, and Scotland is for everybody. It's for everyone to share. But I can understand that the folk who live in some remote and very beautiful places perhaps resent the times of people who turn up. But you know, we all have to live. We all have to share it somehow. But I think what you're saying about perhaps trying to reduce the amount of driving about that you do, and my own particular practice in camping is, you know, leave no traces, an amazing philosophy, where basically if I camp somewhere, the only thing I want to leave behind is a flattened patch of grass. But we can all do. Is that something that you try and do? Leave nothing behind.
Oh yeah. Well, I have this philosophy of trying to leave it nicer.
So it's
like kind of like take nothing but photographs. That sort of philosophy, which you're espousing, which is bang on, right? There's no doubt about it. But you know, I go to places and it's already been littered.
Right.
And that's the idea of like, well, if I turn up, I'll have a litter pick. I'll do a litter pick, and before I pitch, so that I'm pitching somewhere that's got no trace, you know.
Right.
And then I will leave no trace. So even if I'll try and leave no trace, if you like, of the people before me as well, because it just upsets me that I might drive off, and someone will come along and go, "Who's that bastard who left a load of bottles there?"
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, not me.
It's somebody else's. But you know, it's just taking it that little bit further, I think. I mean, the other thing is that, you know, I encourage people to try and get involved in, you know, community actions. So when I was up in Harris, someone had vandalized a local play park, smashed a load of bottles. You know, I got down on my hands and knees, as did the rest of my family, with the community to clear it up.
Right.
And as a result of that, we got talking to local people. And had a good trip because of it. And I think that's really important as well. So I think we can go as far as we can to get involved, understand the places we go to, and try and meet local people and just do good so that they don't think we're just taking from them, you know?
I think that's a very interesting concept, really, that you, because if everybody went round and sort of did a little bit of clearing up, it would make a big difference. I think we've also got to be careful that we don't demonize other people as well, because I think what happened here, certainly after the pandemic, was that a lot of folk came up and camped in places like the NC 500, and they because they couldn't really go anywhere else. And they weren't, how can I put it, there weren't people who were used to camping. There weren't people who sort of you would associate with being in the outdoors. And because of that, they didn't really know how to behave. But that isn't their fault. We shouldn't demonize them for that. Do you think that's right?
I think that's a really reasonable attitude. I admire that. Yeah, absolutely. I think if we need to educate people, then we need to educate people. And
sure,
you know, if that means that the Highland Council provide places for people to overnight, and bins and signage and, you know, leaflets and little reminders that if you're coming to the NC 500, you know, you can wild camp, but here's how you do it properly. And
yeah,
I think education is the thing. You're right, because in the pandemic, it was the only way people could travel.
Yeah.
You know, you had to have a toilet and you had to be self-contained. And that was it. And the Shangri-La, you know, is Scotland. And the NC 500 is the Shangri-La of the Shangri-La. So it's kind of like, it stands to reason, but then maybe we as a kind of community of campers and camper van people need to sort of step up and say, this is how you do it.
Yeah.
So good idea, good philosophy, education.
That's right. So yeah, obviously you're still very active traveling and doing all sorts of. What projects are you working on now then?
I am just finishing off Take the Slow Road, Spain and Portugal. Which is brilliant. and I'm leaving on Sunday actually to go back to Spain to finish the last sort of 4 weeks of travel over there. Fill in the gaps on the map that I've not managed to get to. It's been amazing, actually. It's a really great project. You know, again, I'm questioning whether or not it's right to puff out all that carbon to travel. So I'm trying to slow down a little bit more.
Yeah.
And then once that's done, so that'll be finished when I get back from Spain, that'll be done at the beginning of December. And then next year is another book about Scotland, which will be updating the first book, but also writing another book about sort of getting a bit more off the beaten track. So avoiding the NC 500 and avoiding the Northeast 250 or whatever it is, or the other one in the Southwest.
Oh, they're everywhere.
Yeah, I know. Well, they're so successful, aren't they? And, you know, it's partly to do with the Wild Atlantic Way in Ireland, which is just fantastic. But it's so mega that actually there's no overcrowding.
Right.
So, yeah, just trying to go to places. you know, I want to go to the most remote part, but I can't remember where it is, and go and cycle over the road, over the highest paved road that goes down into Fort William, and just kind of go out of the way, out of the van. So lots of walking, lots of cycling. I did a book, a similar book in England and Wales, and I did things like I kayaked down the Tweed along the Scottish and English border.
Oh, right.
And did that, and I sucked 20 miles along the Thames, and I walked the old trod into Whitby in the North York Moors. So basically just kind of parking up and then going off and having an adventure and getting away from everything.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to that. And hopefully that'll be really low impact as well. So.
Yeah. I mean, it's always a compromise, isn't it? I think, you know, you can't do nothing. So you've got to, you know, you try and balance off what you do. Your books on Spain and Portugal, is it very different traveling there, or is a van and you can go pretty well anywhere?
I mean, you're lucky in Scotland in that you can go pretty much anywhere. Although we know that vans aren't covered by the Scottish Access Code, but people just use it however they want to. They are very tolerant in Spain and Portugal towards wild camping. Last year. They wrote it into law in Portugal, having had a ban over COVID.
All right.
Wild camping is legal in Portugal. In Spain, it's not, but it's very much tolerated. Plus, they provide lots of amenities. So a lot of towns and even a lot of cities will have places where motorhomes can park up, empty their toilets, fill up with water, stay overnight, quite often for free. Because they see the value of it in tourism terms. And that's really refreshing, actually, especially coming from England and especially from Cornwall.
Yeah. One of the major contrasts. I come originally from Merseyside, you know, and me and my dad used to walk around the Wirral. And if you walk around the Wirral, there's keep out private signs, don't come here, beware of the dog, you know, you can't move. I came to Scotland and it was basically, well, you want to go where you want, really. that was a big change.
There's some staggering figures. There's a guy called Nick Hayes who's written a book called The Trespasser's Handbook, I think it's called. It's a really amazing book, a bit like Guy Shrubshaw's book about who owns England. 92% of England is privately owned and we don't have access to it. 92%. And 98% of England's rivers are off limits to the public.
That's horrendous, isn't it?
It really is. Bad. You know, and this idea of enclosure and common land being taken up by big estates all comes back to William the Conqueror. Scotland's got a history of that, but they've managed to overturn it with the Outdoor Access Code.
It's the legislation that we've got. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, but it would never happen in England because there are too many lords of the manor. In the House of Lords protecting their own, and they see us as a great rabble and we shouldn't be allowed, you know, and it's tragic, you know, because these people, you know, are in control of kind of, you know, uplands that are deserts, you know, and the uplands are kept as deserts because they want to make money or take their posh friends shooting.
Well, that's right.
You know, and it's they're devoid of biodiversity and, you know, all this kind of stuff. I'm not necessarily in favour of 100% rewilding, but we need to reforest. And those are the places, you know, if you reforest the uplands, you stop downstream flooding. All that stuff that you already know. So, yeah, that's the problem in England, in a nutshell, in a rant.
Yeah, we could go on about this forever, but I do see in Scotland that it is beginning to change. We're beginning to move away from the massive sporting estates that were vastly overpopulated by deer and were, as you say, essentially green deserts. But that is changing. Deer numbers are coming down. I'm noticing that rewilding and reforestation is happening. So there is hope. There's hope for Scotland. I'm sure there's actually hope for England too, let's hope.
Well, yeah, we'll see. I think Scotland's on the right path. I hope.
Yeah.
And I, you know, that's why I just cannot wait to get back up there because I want to see what's happening. And, you know, if Scotland can do it, then anybody else can do it if they have the will.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. So when can we expect your next book then, Martin?
So Spain and Portugal, Take the Slow Road comes out in May.
Right.
And then I guess Off the Beaten Track will come out the next following year.
Right. Well, that sounds fascinating stuff. And when you come to Scotland, you'll have to let me know, and I'll keep my eye open for your camper, and I can put my tent up next door.
maybe you can show me how to climb a Munro. That would be amazing.
Oh God, I don't know about that.
Or maybe one of the shorter ones.
one with a staircase maybe. Brilliant. Been lovely talking to you. Thanks very much, Martin, and I look forward to your next book.
All right, thanks, John. Take care of yourself.
Bye. Well, that was Martin Dory. I really like that idea. Taking a couple of minutes just to clean up wherever you camp or travel. I'll have to do that in the future myself. You always think you should do something and you sometimes don't get around to it, but that's easy enough to do, isn't it? So I'm going to try that. If you've enjoyed this wee podcast, then do give us a follow or whatever you do to sort of click to see that you get more episodes. If you're interested in the hot tenting that I was talking about, my latest book, The Hot Tent Diaries, is out right now, and you can edify yourself or, well, I don't know, you never read of it, Russell, can't you? Anyway, thanks very much for listening. Do come again. I've been John Burns, and this has been Outdoors in Scotland. Thanks very much.